bring to the Board of Regents, Dr. Sahai?
Well, thank you very much. And I have struggled with that question, too, for quite some time, that what would I bring that somebody else cannot, or if there isn't anybody who's more qualified or more talented than I am to be serving on the board. Just to add to my background, I came to this country in 1967. I was 18 years old at the time, so you can calculate if you're a good math major, then I'm 64 now. My father came to this country in 58 and 59, and he then went to Iowa State Teachers College, as you would remember. That's now UNI. He was a teacher himself, and he was a teacher's teacher, as a matter of fact. He was in charge of the elementary school teachers' college in India. So he wanted to further education, so that's why he chose UNI now, as it's known. My mother was an elementary school teacher herself. My grandparents were teachers. So I think it just behooved for him to come to Iowa State. And then he went back in 59. He was never quite satisfied as to what he could do or what he could accomplish. So he came back in 65 and he called at that time President Marker, who was from UNI, and said, "President Marker, I'd like to come back." He says, "Prem," my father's name, "please come back. We'd be happy to have you." So he came back in 65, leaving his four children and wife behind. And that was pretty tough, actually, you know, not having much as for the assets are concerned or otherwise. So we were always grateful that he could make that type of commitment. He came here in 65, and then he got a job in Webster City teaching and was able to get enough money and then the loan to afford for us to come. So we're always grateful for the opportunities that have been given to us. There's no question, we'll never forget those opportunities given to us. As you mentioned, I went to UNI after coming here. My first 2 years I spent at UNI. I was finishing my master's in biology. I was going to be a teacher. I wanted to do a PhD. I joined the PhD program in biochemistry at Iowa State. I was there for one summer. I got a call from Dr. William, the dean of admissions from University of Iowa. Actually, he didn't call me, no cell phone at the time. I called him to find what the status of my application was. And says, "Subhash, I just sent you a letter of approval of being admitted to medical school." I said, "Hooray." So 69, I went to University of Iowa, finished in 73. Other than 6 months of hiatus out of state of Iowa, in all these years, I've not spent any time more than my vacation time out of state of Iowa. I went to Saginaw, Michigan to finish my family practice, to do my family practice residency. Didn't like it. I came back to Broadlands University and asked Dr. Parker at the time, who was the chairman. I said, "Dr. Parker, would you take me?" And he says, I gave you the first choice the last time. I'll take you again." I said, "Great." So I went back and I told the chairman of family practice, I hope I'm not long-winded. If I'm, just please stop me. I went back to Saginaw, Michigan, and I told the chairman at that time, I said, "I'm not coming back in January." He said, "What do you mean? You have a contract for a whole year." I said, "I know, but you don't want an unhappy resident, and it won't be for your good, for your patient's good, and good won't be good for me." Anyway, he said, "Where are you going?" I said, "I'm not telling you, because if I tell you, I know what's going to happen. You would call that program and just tell them not to take me." And at that time, no computers, so fortunately, I was able to come back to Des Moines, Iowa, and I'm so glad I did. I finished my family practice Broadlands and then started my practice in Webster City, Iowa in 1976, been there ever since. So when I came to this country in 67, I came with my brother, who since expired, and my two sisters, and my mother. So there were five of us who came at the time. And of course, things have changed since, evolved over the last 40-some years, 46 years, so to speak, 45 and a half years. And after having been practicing medicine for so long, being the teacher, the kid, grandchild, continue with that same type of noble endeavor, if you will, teaching the medical students along the way. I've had the PA students and medical students from both the Des Moines University, University of Iowa, and some other schools from other states also from time to time. So why do you want a Board of Regents? I sincerely, truly don't know. I was asked by Governor Culver some time back when he was a governor, if I wanted to serve on a board of medical examiners, said, no, governor, I don't have the time, and I won't do that. And at that time, also, my brother got cancer, so I said, no, I don't think so. But my application, I said, I would serve on board of regents if you want me to, and I sent my application. And so I think my application was still alive in the governor's office. And I had really expressed my interest in serving on board of regents to the present Governor Branstad. So that's how it all started. So this is my story. And I'm happy to answer any questions. I don't know. I think other than being an educator's kid, other than being an educator myself, which, by the way, word doctor in Latin means teacher, I felt that if I can contribute in any way to the education of our children from great state and otherwise, that would be helpful.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
I'm going to ask one question because I haven't seen any other hands go up. In 2004, the Board of Regents adopted a policy that set as a goal, or it was part of their strategic plan to be specific, that they would implement continuous improvement plans in all of their academic programs. Last year, 8 years later, they didn't seem, at least in my eye, to have made a whole lot of progress. So we included in the education reform bill that was passed last year a requirement that each of the universities implement a continuous improvement plan in each of the courses that enroll 300 or more a year. And that would be in effect next fall. And the fall after would be down to courses of 200 and finally to courses of 100 or more. I was wondering, what is your feeling about the concept of the movement for continuous improvement and how else that might be implemented by the Board of Regents?
That's the question always asked, you know, how come the people who get admitted to Ivy League schools, they get better opportunities and all that. I think the measure of a school or any institution is not what they produce at the end, but also what they got and what they produced at the end. So I think something that has to be kept in mind always. So continuous improvement should always be the case. There's no question. Now, if you're talking about taking 300 students per discipline, is that what I'm getting from you in the question?
I'm sorry, say it again.
Are you talking about 300 students per discipline?
No, per course.
Per course.
So that if you had a course that had three sections of 100 each, that would add to 300. We're basically starting with large courses first and working down towards smaller courses.
Some of that might happen because of attrition anyway, as you go up. I guess maybe I'm not understanding the question.
Okay. Well, let me back off from this.
Okay. Please do. Give me a background.
Are you familiar with the concept of continuous improvement, and do you have a vision for implementing that with the universities?
Yes, I do. And I think that should be taken at each university in different disciplines at their level, how they want to pursue it. There's no question about that for continuous improvement. And that should be the goal of any university. I don't see why we shouldn't continue with that.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. I strongly believe, like I say, I'm just quoting the Board of Regents' own strategic plan from, 9 years ago now, that as good as we are today, we have to always try to be better tomorrow, and that principle applies to any organization and any individual, but it particularly ought to apply to the teaching that we do at our universities.
And I would concur with that for sure, yes, sir.
Do we have any other questions for Dr. Sahai? I guess you bowled us over right away.
Yeah, that means I didn't do much in the past, so I don't need any baggage to carry with me. No, I'm kidding. It's indeed a privilege, and I consider it an honor, and I humbly, if I am indeed approved, I would do the utmost I can. I know that the Board of Regents have utmost responsibility on their shoulders, and I know they got voluminous records that they have to review, and I do have very busy practice, but I am fortunate enough to have a daughter-in-law who's a lawyer, and I said, you know, you read pretty fast, so if I pass him the papers too, you can give me your opinion, and she's interested in education anyway. So I would try to do my best, and thank you for giving me the opportunity.
Well, sir, I must tell you, you're a very impressive candidate. We appreciate your willingness to serve and to lend your talents to our great university.
Thank you
for coming today.
Yes, sir.
The next appointee is Mr. Robert Kramer. Mr. Kramer, I'm presuming that you might have something in the way of an opening statement that you might like to make.
That'd be great. Well, thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to come share with you. You know, I realize that this Board of Regents position is very high profile and lately has been becoming too political. So I just want to give you a chance to meet you, and many of you have actually met with you one-on-one, but also to kind of hear from you what your expectations, you know, of this Regents group is. You know, my story started with construction. My dad transferred to Iowa State and graduated in 1950 in ag engineering. And so 40 years later, I come along, so I'm the youngest of six kids, and came along and graduated from Iowa State in construction engineering in 1990. Went to work for the family business. We build bridges, do bridge repairs all around Iowa, Nebraska, Missouri, South Dakota. And in that process, learned a lot about dealing with owners and bidding, you know, competitive bidding and specifications and all the things. I also became a professional engineer by getting my license there 5 years after I started in 1990. So when we heard that the governor was looking for someone who might have some construction engineering background because of all the work that the universities are doing, University of Iowa is supposed to be doing $1.3 billion worth of work over the next 5 years. That's a huge amount. And so I think they thought, and I think probably rightly so, that it'd be good for someone on the board to have that background of understanding the whole competitive bid process, specifications, how do specifications increase or decrease the price, how do you make it bidder-friendly, so that, because a lot of times, like even with DOT, who does a pretty good job of getting the specifications in a way that can get the best price, you don't really know if you have the best price if you don't have all the bidders at the table. So one of my biggest goals would be to try to help that construction process, make it as efficient as possible, but also make it to where it's a partnering atmosphere so that the owner's getting the best value and you're getting as many contractors as possible, you know, to the table. I also serve on the Construction Engineering Advisory Council there at Iowa State, and that's to be ABET accredited, they have to have kind of an industry advisory council to help review what they're doing and kind of look at the curriculum and the credits and all the different things and make sure that they're producing the students that the employers, you know, want to employ. So I have some connection there, and that is actually through one of those contractor friends on that council is where I kind of heard about the administration maybe being interested in someone with construction engineering background. So then I started talking to Scott Newhart there with AGC. Many of you know the Associated General Contractors of Iowa, that is our heavy highway association here in Iowa. And I've been really involved with them and served on the board and then became president in 2010. So had worked a lot of times with Scott Newhart, and we started talking about this issue, and he thought that, this would be a good idea. This would be something I think you could, Robert, could contribute to. Let's go, talk to see if the governor's open to it. They said they were open to the idea. I submitted my name and went through the process and then was interviewed by the governor and lieutenant governor, and they made their selection. I also served 9 years on the Johnson School Board, and it gave me an opportunity to have learn about school finance. And I'm sure, as all you guys know, it is quite complicated, at the secondary level to figure out the whole formulas and everything. But I felt like I really worked hard to understand that and bring a real value to the Johnson School Board. There on the Johnson School Board, we didn't just try to take the number of kids that we had times the value for each student and try to just tax for every dollar we could get. Instead, we tried to come up with a budget that we felt like, you know, funded our priorities. It was something we could defend, and then we went and taxed, you know, appropriately for it. So it was a process that everybody on the board, you know, seemed to embrace, and the superintendent, and that is to work together with something we could defend, and then the community is always behind it if you're looking at things. Instead of just trying to tax as much as you can get, you're doing a legitimate budget that you feel like is what the kids need. And striving for excellence there. But the other piece is that my wife and I have been doing foster care for 4 years now, and we've had 16 kids, you know, come through our house, and we're starting to see, hey, how can we help break this cycle of kids having kids? And one of the big areas is to be able to get them a good college education. So I'd like to see, you know, our state universities, which I'm very proud of, to be as affordable as possible, and high quality and accessible by our students, especially here in Iowa. I'm looking forward to any questions you have, and I've heard here lately that there's been some emails and some things from a couple of board members from Johnston, and so there's some issues I'd sure like love to clear up, but I'll take your questions and take one time and we'll see where it goes.
Well, thank you. I'll again exercise the chair's privilege of asking the first question, and I do want to take you in a somewhat different direction. I appreciate all the service that you've done with the general contractors and with the school board. But the topic I want to ask you about is equal opportunity in education. I speak not just as a member of this education committee and a senator, but also as a faculty member at Iowa State. And it is a strong commitment on my part, and I think on the part of the universities, that we should provide equal educational opportunity to all students, and that we should have a welcoming and accepting environment for those students. They are young adults. They are still in their formative stages. And I think it's very important to treat each and every student with respect. So it comes to my attention, and with some concern, it seems that back about a decade ago, 2001, when the Des Moines City Council was considering including sexual orientation in their civil rights ordinance, you were opposed to that, and you were quoted in the Register June 19th of 2001 as follows, quote, "We should not be elevating chosen behaviors to a protected class." Could you please expound on that a little bit? What did you mean by that?
Yeah. You know, my personal religious beliefs are that that we're created by a loving God, created male and female, and he created marriage, and so marriage should be between a man and a woman. But I understand that other people have different views of that, and so if other people, which many do, have a view that, no, that's something they're born with and can't help, then it falls more into that EEO category. But if you believe more that it's a behavior, then it's maybe not something we should give a protected class to. So how do we reconcile that? Obviously, this group, even right here, is probably divided on that issue. Well, we work together and we tolerate each other, and we work together on finding common ground and finding a win-win solution for everybody, and definitely treat everybody with dignity and respect.
You suggest that sexual orientation is a matter of chosen behavior. Isn't religion also a matter of choice?
Yes.
So you're suggesting we shouldn't, in your personal view, be that concerned about discriminating against chosen behaviors or views. Do you think that discriminating against religion is something that we shouldn't protect against?
No, not at all. It's one of our foundational beliefs is to not discriminate, you know, based on religion. And I don't think anybody should be discriminated against, you know, for any of these personal things. What we're talking about is should we give them their own classification name and add to an EEO list, or should we just treat everybody with dignity and respect? And that would be my bias, is just that we should treat everybody with dignity and respect.
Well, sir, isn't it pretty clear, though, from history that gay and lesbian people have been discriminated against, indeed, I would argue, persecuted in our culture and others? You don't think that requires any special attention?
That definitely shouldn't happen, and when it happens, it should be, should be dealt with. Definitely.
Shouldn't there be legal prescriptions against that kind of persecution and discrimination?
I would just go on the path of letting those people on an individual basis. You know, let's definitely deal with that and make sure, you know, people should be punished if they're discriminating based on those kind of issues.
But aren't they going to be? How would they be punished if such discrimination is not illegal?
Through the legal system, just like, you know, if you were mistreating me, I guess through a civil court. But I, you know, this is getting above my pay grade. I'm an engineer, and I just would like to, at the Regent level, you know, just bring bring my expertise of construction and contracting and do my best to bring differing views, just like you seem to be espousing. Let's bring those views together and try to find a win-win solution.
You were quoted further in the same article, and I'll continue to quote, I hope you don't believe this is the end of the homosexual agenda. This is only the beginning. What are the next steps in the so-called homosexual agenda, in your view?
Well, I'm not any expert. I'm not sure. But I would say...
certainly you must have had something in mind when you made that statement.
I would say that even over the last 10 years, probably the floor has changed a little bit. And so my bias would be, let's say at the region level, if you brought, I don't have any envisions of changing any policies that are in place right now. But if you brought me a policy that was trying to endorse and encourage and promote, you know, homosexual behavior, then I'd say, no, I don't think that's the place, you know, for the university. If you brought me a, you know, trying to promote any other, you know, proselytize people on any other, you know, even on a conservative issue, I would say, no, you know, the university is not the place to try to promote or proselytize. It's a place to be fair and treat people equally, but not necessarily try to promote.
So the Office on LGBT Affairs at Iowa State University, you would be opposed to their existence because you think that they're proselytizing, they're recruiting gay people?
I honestly have no idea what they're doing. So if they're just providing a service to, you know, homosexual students, you know, then, and that's the current policy, that's fine. If they're if they are out there trying to promote and encourage the behavior, then I don't think that's the role of the university.
In 2001, you were opposed to the city of Des Moines adopting an ordinance or altering its ordinance to include sexual orientation as a protected class. Is that still your view with regard to local, state, federal law?
Well, each entity is going to have to decide for themselves. And just like this body and the state legislature can decide those issues, you know, I think at the regents level, you know, whatever the law is, we'll carry out the law.
What would be your choice as a regent as far as the regents' policies are concerned? Board of Regents, the legislature is delegated to the Board of Regents substantial autonomy as far as overseeing the various universities and the special schools. My concern would be, what view would you take into that policy-making process as a member of the board?
I don't have any proposed changes. I don't have anything that I know of that, you know, needs to be done. My bias would be that if you're to try to stay with issues that are promoting education and try to stay with, you know, trying to make it as efficient as possible and, you know, keep the university out of these charged political issues.
Your position in 2001 was to exclude sexual orientation from the protected classes like race, religion, and gender. Is that still your view?
I think any kind of designation let me back up. So everybody ought to be treated with respect and dignity. So I don't think anybody should be mistreated.
Is it your view that designation should be included as a protected class? Is that a yes or a no?
If that's what the law is, then that's what it should be. If I haven't looked at it to see what, if we should be changing, if that is a policy or a law, but I believe that's what the law is. So.
Okay. Senator Hogue, I believe you've asked for recognition.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Kramer, thank you for coming to the committee today. I'd like to explore a little bit more about your interest in construction issues. What do you see, a couple questions with that, what do you see your role as a regent? You're not applying for a job at the university, you want to be a regent, so there may be a little difference there. What do you see as your role as a regent? And also, in terms of construction projects, what do you think the objectives of the university with their construction projects ought to be?
Yeah, thanks for the question. And I'll start with that part. I do think we have to take a big look at what we're doing, what we're building. We'd hate to go spend billions and go build and then with a changing, you know, campus mentality that maybe isn't so building structured. So that's something we definitely ought to be looking at is, do we need all the buildings that we had before over there in Iowa City? It's due to flood damage and things. So we decided to take a healthy look at what is the most efficient way of transferring, you know, information for a good education. So start with that. But I think, you know, with the regent taking a high level view of really structure, you know, what is the, and then letting the employees of the university and the people who work there, you know, do the best they can with that, but trying to give a structure, and as the chairman mentioned about, you know, continual improvement, that's a really good function of a board or the Board of Regents. And that is not trying to do top-down whatever Robert Kramer wants, but instead trying to give a structure to where the people who work there and can take ownership of it and make changes and improve, and then they have a reporting and accountability to just of being able to, you know, report back and tell, you know, how they're doing, just, you know, so they'll get it done. But it's not a trying to impose from the top down. It's definitely a I'd like to see groups come together and on their own and come up with the best policies.
But you didn't mention something that's important to me, and I just want to get your views on it. Even if it's not the lowest cost project, do you think that the university has an obligation as a public entity to meet higher labor or environmental standards for building projects than maybe other building projects might have that obligation on?
We would want, let me take, just kind of split them up maybe. Give me a little more description of what you mean by labor. So as far as what kind of labor policies are you referring to?
Well, I don't know. Do you think it's appropriate for the university to use, if the university wants to, that the university should use project labor agreements on projects? Do you think that the university has an obligation to exceed minimum building standards for energy efficiency and environmental performance? Or do you think the university's job is to build the lowest economic cost project that might be available?
Well, and I probably would try to separate those two things. As far as labor goes, I think as a public institution, your best bet is to try to get as many bidders as you can. So you don't want to exclude bidders by project labor agreements or things that'll just cause any. And the truth is, actually, a lot of union contractors don't even like project labor agreements because it's not the deal they negotiated. You know, they negotiated with their own with labor, and then of course non-union companies don't like losing that you know, control. So I would lean against trying to do project labor agreements if it would limit the bidding pool. And then on the environmental things, I think the board just has to look at that and see if it makes sense. I don't feel maybe an obligation of spending money just to spend money to say you did it, but if there's a true positive impact to the environment and to the school, then more power to them.
Thanks, Mr. Carroll.
Senator McCoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Craig.
Excuse me. Senator, I apologize. I call on you out of my preferred order.
Okay.
I think we're going to allow members of the committee to have questions first. And then, if you wouldn't mind waiting
until
after the committee members.
Not at all.
I appreciate your being here today. And your
appropriate.
Interest.
Thank you.
Senator Butker, you're next on my list.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you both very much for being here and for your willingness to serve. As I look at education and technology and how things have changed so much in the past 15 years, how do you see the university playing, what roles do you see the university playing, or how do those roles change, or what do you see for the future of universities?
And I'm not an expert by any means, but I certainly want to explore everything we can. You know, there's a lot of ways of bringing education to students, you know, efficiently that might not be the way that we've always done it. So I would certainly come in with a bias of let's try to open up and see what other alternatives there are and do multiple things. I don't think it has to be either or. We can still keep a, you know, conventional structured classroom as well as reaching people online. So, but you know, I think the staff are probably better equipped than I am to come up with all the solutions. But I certainly come in with an open mind of looking at those.
I can just tell you from my personal experience. In 1967, when I came here, if you want to make a telephone call to India, it cost you $12 for the first 3 minutes. You had to call somebody in England. They had to connect you to the operator in India. And then you had to be around the phone for that 4 or 5 hour period before they could get hold of you. So we know what technology has done. And I know what my kids do with technology and what I do. we recently instituted electronic medical records in our hospital, and my people, computer people at the hospital and at my office had the patient with me. And I told them point blank, it's going to be age divided by 3, the number of hours they're going to need to teach me the same stuff. So indeed, the things have changed. To make a long story short, our cars, as you know, have more computer power than Apollo 14 did. That's just the way it has been. It's going to change. Our whole educational system is going to change. And some of it may be via the electronic system, i.e. Skype or whatever else, and the healthcare will be provided the same way maybe. As a matter of fact, I have a call to the psychiatrist from Iowa City. If somehow they can help provide the services to our small hospitals for psychiatric, that's so lacking in our in state. I was at the last regents meeting, I was surprised that the number 48 in the psychiatric services in the state, the lack of the services, lack of number of beds. So I think University of Iowa can play a very, very important role in providing those services to smaller institutions. But they won't be able to do that unless they're given adequate funding to do that. So that burden is going to lie on you folks to provide that kind of money, to provide that kind of resources, those kind of resources. So it's going to continue to change. I can't fathom what's going to be like 10 years from now, but I do know this, that we're all going to have to live with it. I do know this, that our students are going to be served better if they have those type of services available to them. And I do know this, that if we don't do it, other countries are doing it. There's no question about that. So might as well take lessons from them and also from ourselves and move forward.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Mathis.
Mr. Kramer and Dr. Sahai, thank you for being here today. Thank you for your willingness to serve as well. I agree with Senator Mr. Kramer, you and I had an earlier conversation about construction, and when I asked you how you came to the conclusion that you thought you were qualified to serve, and we talked about your background in construction, and you used the words they urged me to seek this appointment. And when I pushed you on that, you said it was a general contractor from Rhinebeck or a contractor who urged you to do that. And I asked you if the governor actually asked you to serve, and you said no, that you approached the governor. Can you talk a little bit more about the reasons that, you know, your motivation to serve as a regent within construction a little bit more, but then tell us how you're qualified to take a look at curriculum and academic freedom?
Yeah, thanks for the question. Started with this co-worker on the Construction Engineering Advisory Council and just mentioning that he had heard that there was this need for maybe someone with some construction engineering background, meaning I don't know if he heard it through the regents or through the governor, you know, office, but you know, it was just out there, and that he kind of thought of me. And the reason he thought of me was because I'd worked on the AGC for so long and served on the executive committee then through 5 years, served as president. And during that time, really one of my strengths was bringing people together, even when we had a tough issue, differing views, bringing them together and coming up with a good solution. He'd also had known me even through my time on school board and some of my other interactions, and so he thought I'd be good for that. So then when I say they, I think I meant the Construction Association. I started talking to AGC and mentioned that this person had kind of recommended me, and they said, oh, that'd be a great idea. And they were the ones who then, yeah, talked to the governor's office and just asked if they'd be open to that. They said they'd be open. So I submitted my online application and then went through the process and then had an interview and went from there. Did that answer the question?
Yes, that does. I do have a question for both of you then. In regard to Mr. Kramer, I know you serve on the chair of the Family Theater. And at the U of I, they do embryonic research and stem cell research and part of the genome project. How do you reconcile, how do you believe in your position on the Family Theater versus that? And Dr. Sahai, how do you feel about embryonic and stem cell research at the university level?
And actually I'm not even aware exactly what their policies are and if they were even doing that. I don't come in with a, you know, preconceived idea of making any changes, but I'm unashamedly pro-life. You know, I believe life does begin at conception, and we you know, we should try to protect life as much as we can. So we'll have to see how that. I'm not sure, you know, what their policies are there, or if, what the, you know, if they're, if the, what the region's position would be on that. But I come in with a, with an open mind to listen about what they're doing.
Well, I'm, a couple of things about me. I'm not a fanatic about anything. I'm a fan of lots of things. And this is one of the things I think I'm a fan of. I think the cell, stem cell research and the advances made in that has a lot to help us along, you know, with diseases that we don't have solutions for right now. I'm not an absolutist in the sense that it's going to be this or that type of thing. I think this, the question always comes up is, are we going to take those stem cells from the fetuses that have been aborted or not? But that's a mute point, because that's not the fray or the question I should be getting into. I think the decision should be made, is there any way to accomplish the same thing? No, none of us, and I'm sure I can say for all of us, none of us want abortions. There's no question about that. But circumstances are, things happen. I don't have any control over those issues. I think that's the legislature to decide. We have to live with the laws that you pass. But if there's anything we can do from stem cell to move ahead and help with some of the chronic diseases, sure, can be done. Now, having said that, there are other ways to get stem cells too. You do not have to always go to the embryonic cells to get the stem cells, even though they're the most omnipotent cells, if you will. And therefore, easily can accomplish the job. So I think that should be left up to the research workers. What is for the best of the humanity as such? And only the person who has to deal with it sometimes can tell you more, what's more important to them. For me as such, I'm not against stem cell research, if that's what you're looking at. I'm for it. I'll be willing to put monies into it. As a state, I think state legislature, state people, we should be putting money into it. As to how we accomplish that goal, I think that is something that can be discussed further.
If I could add to that, you know, that's a great example of coming up with a win-win solution. You know, you have a where a lot of people are very concerned about using stem cells from the fetus, but if you can use stem cells from, you know, umbilical cord or from other areas and can do just as much or better, then that's a great solution to solve that dilemma. Yeah, I think if the I don't have any issues coming in or any bias against doing that kind of thing. If the federal my initial bias would be that if there's no strings attached that are forcing us to do something we don't want to do, then let's partner with them and let's try to use it the best we can.
You can explain no strings attached.
Well, I'm just trying to keep covering myself in case there were some, I don't know the specifics of the issue you're talking about. So if a lot of times with federal funds, there might be some sort of thing of strings attached of forcing us to, you know, do policies or do it the way they want to do it, or, you know, or even like into the stem cell issue, you know, if they were forcing us to move towards embryonic as opposed to, you know, umbilical cord, you know, but as a general answer, I'd say we partner with them and we try to use it the best we can. Yeah, stem cells in general, I think it's great. Yeah.
What about embryonic stem cells?
And so if we're, you know, if it's involves where it's a new process and it was involving the killing of embryos or something, you know, then we'd have to, you know, I'd take a look at that and see if that's what, you know, what we really want to do. But if it was, But if the funding was kind of open and letting us do it the way we want to do it, or letting the universities, rather, do it the way they want to do it, then I think more power to it.
You don't have any issues then with federal funding and partnerships other than those?
Right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, gentlemen, for being here. I'm going to take a little bit of a provincial view here. This committee represents the demographics of the state. So does the Board of Regents. Right now, I think that you could argue that this state's demographics would be different if we had a public university that had been located in Western Iowa. How do you see the board probably increasing its presence, its outreach in Western Iowa, which is so much different than Eastern Iowa in a number of towns? And you're competing with Lincoln, you're competing with Brookings, you're competing with Vermillion, and you come from Western Iowa. You might have some view about that, and we have had Board of Regents meetings at the Lakeside Lab, which is an international laboratory of much renown in diatom research up at the Iowa Great Lakes. But I would just be interested in knowing, there was a day when Iowa State would make regional tours and really get out and promote Iowa State, and I haven't seen one of those in a long time. But do you see any role there in the Board of Regents of bringing your presence, all the way to the Missouri and the Big Sioux River?
Well, I think that'd be great. And, you know, with Iowa State with a record enrollment, I guess maybe they've decided they don't have to do much more outreach. But it'd be great if they did. And I think we have the opportunity to get out. And I think as part of kind of what I hear and you're saying, too, is even as the regents, as far as getting out with meetings around the state, and also that whole transparency, issue. And if I had a chance to talk with Senator Danielson about some of the things he's promoting there with the transparency bill, and I think it's a great idea. That the more transparency, the better, as far as the Board of Regents go. And in fact, as a board member, I'd really like to see it because I'd want to protect myself if we're making big dollar decisions to make sure we're doing it in an open, transparent way that the whole state can see, so that we're not accused of anything under the table.
I would echo that. There's no reason why not. I mean, you like you mentioned that the three state universities are jewels for our state, and they really are. Not appreciated sometimes as much by the people at large, and I think it'd be a good idea to take that to the different places. Mechanics of that, I think that has to work for the Board of Regents and universities. All the presidents have to be there, everybody has to be there, the facilities have to be provided. So I don't know how that's going to work out, but if the service, if it can be provided, my goodness, I'm going to travel to Iowa City, I might as well travel to Sioux City, or South, or North.
Well, I invite you to Western Iowa, especially Northwest Iowa, and I hope that we can resume those regents meetings at Lakeside Lab, which is a regent site. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Zong.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Doctor and Mr. Kramer, I thank you for taking the time out today to spend with us and answer some questions, and I know that it's not easy to be in your chair today. I think it's been very public that I've been very frustrated with the Board of Regents in general. I think that there's a limited amount of accountability, particularly because they're not as close to the people as what we are. And that's why it's such a serious responsibility for us, with all the appointments, to vote them or not vote for them. And at times I have split from my leadership, my party, and done what I thought was right. My biggest frustration with the Board of Regents is I think they forget about the parents and the students that are writing the checks. We've had all kinds of examples. I believe they've become out of touch. I certainly get frustrated that it seems like it's more political contributors that get to be on this board, both Democrat and Republican, since I've been down here. And as a parent of a son that's at UNI that's going to be transferring to Iowa, and I think I'm going to have another son that's going to be going through the Regents University. I certainly believe that they are forgotten about. I recognize that there is one student that's on the Board of Regents, but he certainly, I don't think he, students and parents get, she, do not get the opportunity, as well as most of the students, to talk to you all and say, hey, listen, What I've seen is a trend in the universities where education expenses are out of control. Student debt is out of control for these kids. Not to mention, you know, my wife and I, we try to help out, as all the parents do. I recognize the ability that both of you have, and I think you're both set up perfectly for this job. Doctor, I agree with you. We need more people with a medical background, certainly at the University of Iowa, as well as you mentioned that a doctor is a teacher. I certainly, your expertise in construction, and I might add that your job, both of you, is to look out for the taxpayer, the parents, and the students of the state of Iowa. I was in the construction business, or a subsidiary of the construction business, and the project labor agreements are okay as long as it doesn't drive up the cost to all of us citizens, you know, taxpaying citizens. The LEED projects are a great idea, but they're very expensive, and what I see with LEED projects, mostly the platinum certification, is that only governmental entities could afford this, very seldom, because they cost so much. With that said, my frustration has been with this tuition set aside, and I felt like that the Board of Regents have held the legislature hostage in doing away with that program, and if you're, I assume you're both familiar with that program. So my question to both of you is, do you support shutting down the tuition set aside? And secondly, if we don't follow through with the amount that's been demanded by the Board of Regents, will you follow through with shutting down the tuition set aside? And what effect that'll have? If we come through with our money, will you lower the tuition and inequality that with the amount of money that we've gained by the state legislature appropriation?
Let me answer first. It's going to be difficult to answer exactly what we would do because I don't know all the details going in. Here's my understanding is that the, I believe before the tuition set aside was kind of created by people paying, the kids who were paying tuition, a percentage of that was being set aside for helping others with scholarships and helping try to get in. And I think it might have surprised some people to find that out, and so they thought, oh, here we go again, another way of redistributing people's money, and they didn't know it. And so I can kind of understand, you know, the frustration of finding that out. But on the other hand, we do want to make it as accessible for the kids who need it and are needy. And so, so what is the better solution? You know, so if I was given two choices, you know, the taxpayers paying it or the kids paying tuition, I would probably say, well, if we think this is a worthwhile thing to do for all of us, then maybe we all ought to be contributing, which would mean more, you know, from the taxpayer side. But maybe there's a better, even win-win solution and a better way to help and kids, you know, be able to attain college and not have that huge debt around their neck at the end. So I'd come in with a bias of trying to find a win-win-win solution that maybe we come up with some kind of solution that would reach out to these kids that wouldn't cost as much out of other people's pockets, but give them an opportunity. Maybe it's some kind of work program through college or some way to work their way through. I have no idea what it is, but I certainly enjoy the challenge of trying to find a better solution.
Well, we're one of the advanced countries, if you will, that does not provide public education at the higher education level. That's unfortunate, so be it. We have to deal with what we've got. But we also know that education is a great equalizer. That's just the way it is. You know, to improve any society, any culture, you have to have the education. Our focus should always be the students and students alone. Not the teachers, not the university, not you, not me. It's the students. If they're getting the adequate education, they're getting the education they deserve at their level, and they can advance their career, I think that's what it should be. Money should be secondary. Now, how we provide for that, I think that has to come from either the own funding, the public funding, the private funding, whatever it has to be. And then, so the deserving students should be able to get that education. So that's number one. Number two, I think it was well said by Harvard President Bach, if you think education is expensive, try ignorance. So I would simply state to a student that yes, you do go out with a loan, and sometimes it appears to be burdensome. But at the same time, we know what the education means to you, what it means to society. We will help you the best we can. So if the Board of Regents is coming to you for additional funding, it's not because we want to hold you hostage. We come to you because we need those funds to make sure the kids of this great state get their adequate education. We are not sponsoring the students from out of state. I can tell you that for right now. because they pay twice as much tuition, I think, as much as our in-state students do. So if we have qualified students, we have quality students, we produce them, I think that's the best asset we've got at this point. So believe me, I don't think I'd be coming to you holding you, or so to speak, as a hostage. I think I want to provide the best education I can for the kids.
Thank you.
I would forewarn both of you gentlemen, Senator Zaun is a very hard fellow to satisfy. This year he filed a bill to abolish the Department of Education. If you guys don't watch out, the Board of Regents might go next. Senator Ernst is the next on my list.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For both of you, thank you very much for being here. We really do appreciate it very much. Yesterday, I sat down with a graduate student who was working on a project rebranding Iowa. He and his classmates have this project. So what they are trying to do is figure out what can we do in the state of Iowa to keep our talent here. And for you, Mr. Kramer, you have had a number of children grow in your home, your children, your foster children. And as we send them off to the Regents universities, what can they do between the Regents universities, businesses? What do you see? Do you have a vision for keeping the talent that we have here in Iowa as they complete their courses?
Well, and a lot of this probably falls more on you than it will on us as the Regents, and that is trying to just have an environment where our economy is growing, and we have jobs, and we have jobs to offer, you know, those kids getting out. I think at a Regent level, one is partnering with the businesses here to make sure we're producing the graduates that they need, and then also making the communication connection, you know, getting them in front of them so they see, you know, what the opportunities are here in Iowa. The other thing too is, you know, I think we all should be proud of the values, you know, that we have here in Iowa. And, you know, you think of Stephen Covey's, you know, the laws of the farm. You know, there's just great, you know, just great character-building things that people in Iowa have that, you know, not everybody, of course, now I'm on TV, not everybody in the country, you know, promotes. But those things that we can all come together and agree on, let's promote those things and try to play. This is a great place to raise kids and have your family. So stay here in Iowa.
I would agree with all that. I think the two important things that we can do is provide them the opportunities and provide them the challenge. If they don't have the good students and good, excellent graduates, they don't have the challenge, I don't care what monies you have for them, they won't stay. You have to have the opportunity for them. That goes for the teachers too, as far as that goes. So they have the opportunity, but more importantly, after that, they should be challenged along the way. If they're not challenged, they won't stay. Why would they? There should be a reason for it. Then they become complacent. The whole thing becomes pretty stale. So you have to provide the opportunities. We have to emphasize how good our state is. And believe me, if they find the opportunities here and they find the challenges here, they will stay. We won't have to go out and attract them. They would just, you know, we will be just, you know, magnet ourselves. And, you know, that's something we found in our private practice. We found that even though it was pretty difficult to recruit the doctors to come practice in a small town, but once we get them, they just love the challenge. They're just odd. You know, they might have learned that at University of Minnesota, University of Iowa, or whatever, but they say, my God, this is just amazing. This is different what we can do. So, and I always tell them that too. I said, if you're not challenged, then unfortunately, you're not doing your job or I'm not doing my job.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair. I appreciate the opportunity. Gentlemen, thanks for being here. We've been admonished the last couple of days to make sure that we're talking about the Board of Regents in a non-political way, that the office has become far too political. And so I want to talk to you not about anything political, but about something that really matters. And, Mr. Chair, you hit on this earlier, continuous improvement. And there are two key things that I want to know about the two of you, the deal with continuous improvement. I'd like for you to speak to those. The first one is your experience as an engineer. Your experience as a doctor. Talk to me, talk to this group about what you can do beyond the brick and mortar, beyond just serving on this board and making decisions. What you can do as an individual to be involved in the continuous improvement of the education of our students. This is very, very specific to me. I have two students who in your six-year tenure will be joining a Regent University, and I'm excited about that. But I want to know what you're doing to make their educations better. Second of all, what are you going to do with those two boys and the other children who will be attending there. What are you going to do with them to help involve them in the process of continuous improvement and decision-making about their lives and their futures? Thank you.
I'll go first this okay. time. How's that? And that's a very, very good question. I mean, that comes up all the time. I have three kids. All of them are doctors. Unfortunately, none of them settled in the state. One is in Phoenix, one is in Rochester, New York, and one is in Chicago. So there you have it. You know, that, but fortunately, that's not the story for a number of people. But we also do know that the students from this state, the graduates of this state are coveted all over the country. There's no question about that. That was true for University of Iowa back in 1973 when I graduated. That's true today. And that's because of the work ethic of this place. And there's no question about that. It goes back to, again, the same thing. Provide them the opportunity, provide them the challenge. If you have the universities who are taking important and a critical role at the kids at the early stage, like, I'm not talking about their, you know, freshmen when they get into the school. I'm talking about junior high. I'm talking about the middle school, etc. That's when the change is going to be made, not when they're almost juniors or seniors ready to graduate. So I think the universities do play a very critical role, an important role, reaching to those students at that point. Now, whether they stay in the state or not is going to be dependent on what we can provide for them.
And what do you personally bring that will also provide continuous?
I would provide them. Personally, I would provide the same thing I do to my students now. I simply tell them point blank. I said, you know, if you don't improve yourself every day, the complacency is going to be just like termites for the house. It slowly kills you, and you don't even know it. So it's important that you keep on improving yourself and you provide that environment for them to grow. Because if that environment is not there, they're not going to grow. They're not going to change. What would I do personally? I do the university the same thing. I say, you know, the teachers who are still teaching the courses from 20 years ago, what they were teaching, are not going to survive. It's just not going to happen. That's just not the way it should be. It's inexcusable.
Yeah, I agree that, you know, it starts with a personal dedication to wanting to improve, and I really do hunger after learning more. And when I was on the school board, learning the whole education world was a lot different than the construction world and the engineering world. But I really enjoyed that new information, and there's tons of it up there at the university level for me to get exposed to. So I'm looking forward to learning more. But I also think that, as we talked before, that's one of the things that Regents can do. Because I don't think Regents can go change, you know, they're going to change people's minds a lot, you know, trying to do the Robert Kramer, you know, school of whatever, you know, isn't going to work. What Regents can do is set up a structure such as continuing improvement where you empower the administration to start going to their departments and start putting in a process where they are going through improvement cycle, you know, that never ends. And you know, and then they report back and they tell you, you know, how they're going. They set goals and, you know, and they meet them. And it can kind of permeate all the way down through to the students to where they catch a hold of it and they get involved in the process and they're, you know, wanting to improve themselves and improve the whole student atmosphere. So, yeah, I can get excited about trying to set those kind of things in place, but not me trying to set my values, but rather these empowering people to improve themselves.
More committee member, Senator Dvorsky, is seeking attention and seeking the floor. And then, Senator McCoy, I promise it'll be your turn. I would deal with that issue this morning. Senator Dvorsky.
Thank you. I'm just seeking the floor on attention.
You seem to be collecting a few microphones.
Anyway, I want to bring up something that I think is lifeblood or should be of the Regents Universities or public universities, and that's free and open exchange of ideas. And I wonder what your views are on academic freedom and how, as a member of the Board of Regents, you would enhance academic freedom for all the Regents and stop those who are sort of taking that away.
Yeah, I'm very much in favor of more information is better. We're dealing with adults, students. So if we can give all theories, if we can give more science, if we can give more ideas, and so they can to challenge them with coming up with their what they believe, then I think that's great. Yeah, I really appreciate you bringing that up, because I'd really like to kind of clarify what happened. I heard there's some emails floating around, some different things, and I really don't think accurately depicted it. In fact, so here I served 8 years on the board before that kind of happened, and in fact I went to high school with Senator Peterson, and my reputation through high school I thought was a positive thing, as a positive influence on people, getting to the business world and serving with high ethics and with the DOT, I feel I have a reputation of being fair and also being honest and integrity. And then I run into this thing, and it really smeared my reputation. I think it's very unfortunate. I actually brought the letter I sent out. So we went through this book issue, which I'll tell you about in a second. And the letter, I just give this maybe, I can email it to you all or to the chair and let him distribute it. But I think when you read the letter, you'll be surprised at how it's been depicted, because I don't think it's nearly as inflammatory as being made out to be. But what happened was the three people that I endorsed did win, and so that did upset a lot of people. Well, then we were split, and so the next couple pages are my oral response at the next board meeting of how we said, okay, well, let's put these differences aside and try to how we're going to work together and really come back together and get things done. And so I think you'll appreciate seeing that. But the book issue that led up to it nobody wanted to ban books, nobody wanted to remove them from the classroom or the library or anything. Parents brought to us an issue where they were concerned about the age appropriateness of a particular book. It had a very graphic scene in it. And they just felt like for 14, 15-year-olds, maybe that wasn't appropriate. The teachers also had chosen a backup book, and when they had parents complain about the first book, they would have the kids read the other book. And this isn't a selective book. This is one they were being forced to read and as a group and discuss as a group. So it was part of the curriculum. The board was supposed to approve all the curriculum. So it came to the board level. And the question was, should we use this book that half the community doesn't think is age appropriate? Or we started asking questions about this backup book. Does it meet all the qualifications? Does it meet the criteria? Oh, yes, yes, yes. Does it give you just as good an education? Yes, yes, yes. Well, let's just use that book then. There's no controversy on this one, and the community can agree, and here's a win-win solution. Let's do it. And then they said, no, you're trying to ban this other book and take it away from us. And so then it turned into a book banning issue, which I didn't think it was. So in my mind, I was trying to find a win-win solution for parents. They were trying to get something that was age-appropriate for everybody, that everybody agreed to, and that's how I would go forward. At the regent level, we're not going to deal with age-appropriateness because you're talking about adults, but I'd also take that same philosophy of trying to bring people together and come up with a good win-win solution. Yeah, no, absolutely. My bias is that the more information, the better. So if that means academic freedom, open it up, let the teachers teach what they want to teach, and let the students hear all the different theories and possibilities and decide for themselves, as opposed to some board or somebody trying to dictate.
Doctor? I would just simply add to that, that to me, the academic freedom comes with responsibility. If you're going to use that or abuse that academic freedom, then I'm not sure that's a freedom in itself. So any of these things have to be taken at the face value. That's all I can tell you. Yes, the professor should have the academic freedom to teach, but not whatever they want to teach. I think there should be under certain guidelines. And then I think that depends on the university, the professor, and the president, and et cetera. That's not up to me to decide, except in those circumstances that may be way out of norm, and then we can discuss them at the time when they come.
Thank you. Okay. Chairman, I ask a question if you have to end your list. It'd be a real short one.
I promised Senator McCoy the next opportunity, Senator. You remember the committee.
Thank you. I talked to you. We interviewed
tell me how, did you talk to the superintendent, to the teacher before you went on this crusade?
Yeah, and I think crusade is not an accurate word. I mean, I wasn't the one leading this. The parents brought this to the board. The superintendent actually set up a committee, and so a couple of teachers and the parents kind of met and tried to work out something. The teachers didn't want to back off of that book, and so it finally ended up at a board meeting. But yeah, it wasn't anything I was crusading, and so the superintendent was involved, you know, through the process. And one more comment, so then we also tried to, when the board was split 4-3, come up with a compromise thing where that we would mail letters to the parents and try
what
to come
to a solution. What did the superintendent recommend to you?
So he recommended this compromise solution of, well, we'll send letters to the parents and advise them.
Did you follow the superintendent's advice?
Yes. What happened was at that meeting, I was actually called ahead of time and was told by the board president that they had 4 votes, you know, to go with that solution. So we got in the meeting and I said, hey, you know, I think I know that a lot of the parents have questions about the age appropriateness of this book. I've been told that we're outnumbered. The 4 members are going to vote to keep the book for sure. So I'm going to vote with this compromise solution, which was the superintendent's. And that is, we'll send out letters to the parents and advise them of what's going on, give them a choice, give them a little chance to have the other book, you know.
Okay, we then ask unanimous consent to recognize Senator McCoy. Seeing no objections, then you have the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Kramer. It's a pleasure to have you before the committee. Thank you for your willingness to serve. I wanted to go back to your opening statement where you stated that lately the Board of Regents had been becoming too political, and you recognize the high profile of the regent position. I want to ask you this question in light of that statement. It's my understanding that and I had an opportunity to see your video that was posted on YouTube. You may not even know it's out there, but it was from the family leader, and you were celebrating the defeat of 3 judges that ruled, in your opinion, incorrectly on the marriage equality issue. In light of that high profile position, in light of the fact that as a Johnson School Board member, you stated for the record that you believed that the liberal agenda was out of control and that these books were part of the liberal agenda, as well as, attacking an individual that had recommended that the school look at a form of contraception that would involve distribution of condoms through the school system. In light of some of these roles that you played, Is it fair to assume that you will be bringing an equal amount of political poison to the Board of Regents that could potentially have a lightning rod effect in light of the fact that you do have some very, very conservative and very outspoken views, that you have taken positions that are far outside the norm on some of these issues?
There are several things in that question that I might contend with, but let me just say that I don't see the regent's role as promoting these issues. So yeah, I'd rather keep these social issues, you know, away from them and just focus on education. So my bias would be to if someone on the conservative side was trying to come in and thinking that we need to promote something, hey, no, let's just stick with education. If someone on the other side was trying to promote some of these things you just talked about, I'd say, no, that's not really the role of the regents. Let's not promote this stuff. Let's just stick with focusing on education. But my best thing that I bring to the table, I believe, is you and I have these differing views. I can guarantee you that you and I can sit down and we can talk through them and try to come up with win-win solutions and to come up with policies that tolerate each other's views. And that's what the beauty is of our whole system is that's an essence of tolerance, is putting up with, if we all had the same views, then it wouldn't be tolerating, you know. But since we have different views and we can still work together, that's a great thing.
And as a, you know, as a, I would just say as a follow-up, I mean, I'm not sure, you know, I guess to address the issue of how you brought a school board together in light of the letters that I've read. I served with I went to high school with Mike Farrell, who's your president of the school board, who's written me and asked me to oppose your confirmation. And it's primarily because what I'm reading is their concerns about your lightning rod politics that you bring into the process. So how would that not play if we have demonstrated 9 years on the school board where your actions were anything but agreeable to all the folks on the school board, and in light of your very public role in a very political organization that campaigns heavily and invests heavily in candidates as chair of that organization, how would that not be carried into the Board of Regents?
Well, that's why I'd look forward to giving you a copy of this to see, because I did see Mr. Farrell's email there, and I've never met Mr. Farrell face-to-face, but he's serving on the board now. But he evidently wasn't involved with, you know, the board at the time that we went through all that, because I believe after you read this in the response, you'll kind of wonder, well, how did they kind of jump to some of those accusations? And you say my 8-9 years on the board are nothing but, well, the reality is, the only thing that people are talking about out of those 9 years is this one issue. And it's been, like I say, blown out of proportion. So I think that my reputation of working on with the Construction Association, working with other people out in the community, that's what has, and working with the DOT and different owners, that's what I think you'd find a better representation of how I am to deal with, and that is to bring people together and not try to polarize.